It's 10 after 11 o'clock. Welcome to the third and final hour of the show. Yeah, look, Percy, in terms of the SIU, don't forget that much of the work that they do is really around civil matters, right, and being able to get back monies that have been ill-gotten. The true work of the prosecuting really lies with the prosecution authorities, which is the NPA and the investigative directorates, the hawk. So, yeah, it just sometimes they do the best that they can under the circumstances. Well, our final conversation of this morning is focusing on the on universal basic income and the question really around its implementation in South Africa. Where are we with that conversation now? Nomahlubi Jakuja is head of research at the Social Policy Initiative. Nomahlubi, good morning to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Good morning, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be on SAFM and to have your listeners listening to us and what we have to say. Thank you.
Russell Wilderman is a social policy specialist at the United Nations Children's Fund. Russell, good morning.
Good morning, Kathy, and fantastic to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to participate, and good morning to your listeners as well.
Nomahlubi, let me kick it off with you. When we look, I guess, just more broadly at the conversation around a universal basic income, it seems that the conversation in South Africa has moved quite far. And what I mean by that is that activists and people like yourselves that have really been at the forefront of initiating the need for some form of basic income in the country have done well to not only bring this conversation to the fore, but have it be a conversation that now also finds itself, spoken about in the corridors of our national treasury, in the corridors of the presidency. So there has been this elevation around the need for a basic income. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, Kathy. And I think it stems from not just even the Social Policy Initiative, but the people and the voices in the space. And also globally, there has been a wide recognition of a universal social security safety net. And this is indicative of the platforms where SPI has been invited to sit on, including the Universal Social Security Network, which is based in the US, as well as BN in the UK, and also the Amplifying Voices for Africa, which is a regional platform of think tanks, where really the need for universalism in our approach to social security has been amplified. And I think you're looking uniquely in South Africa, it's also just recognizing the high unemployment levels. And while a universal basic income grant is not a replacement for job creation, but it is a question of how do people in the meantime, while they are unemployed and looking for employment, how can we as a state and a society afford them a life of dignity where they at least can become active participants in the economy? And that said, at looking at social policy differently, where it actually can be used and has been used by many different countries to stimulate an economic activity.
Russell, do you get the sense that even from a policy perspective, we are closer to the implementation of a basic income grant? And I say that because we look at the implementation of the Social Relief of Distress grant that started, of course, under COVID. It was meant to be a once-off, but it has stayed with us and it's still with us today. One doesn't know what's going to happen after the 29th of May, but that in and of itself, can we see that as an indication of the recognition for the need for such a grant in our society?
Kathy, thank you so much for the question. I think both Norma and I and yourself will agree that we do need an intervention. We are sitting with record levels of hunger among women and children. So it is inevitable that South Africa needs to make a constructive and positive decision about how do we approach what many of us consider to be a calamity. It's worrying. It's difficult. And from a human-centered point of view and a child rights-centered point of view, it is vital that we need to look at the most weakest of our constituencies. That being said, I don't see a complete national consensus on what needs to be done. Everyone is saying something needs to be done, but there's no national consensus yet about whether the intervention specifically is indeed the universal basic income or some form of universal basic income support, or whether there's going to be a mix of different kinds of interventions. Clearly, from an official policy perspective, we had the consistent sort of deferral of big decisions around universal basic income and therefore the continuation. That situation reads to me more like uncertainty, reads to us more like a decision, a firmer decision needs to be taken that is supported, I think, by the political elite, by the political class, and by civil society, and by everyone concerned. Because I think it's not clear to us where this is going to land. Just by way of an example, people are talking about the crisis of funding in basic education. People are talking about the necessity of implementing the national health insurance. So where do all of these different things land? Where Norma and I and SPA and UNICEF consistently agree is that we definitely need a very constructive and positive intervention at this point in time. Whether that's the UBI, it's still an open question as far as we are concerned, because we don't dictate policy to the South African government. We're here to support the South African government in what it is trying to do. Kathy?
Let's talk about what is happening in the rest of the world when it comes to social interventions, especially by way of a protection net that is required. In this country, Nomahlubi, we're dealing with what is the highest level of inequality. And really, what that means is that if there's any income that an individual is earning, whether it's by way of a temporary job or even a permanent job, their life and their experience of life in South Africa is radically different to that of somebody who is not employed. And when we look at those numbers, we are talking about millions of people in this country, the majority of whom are young people, the majority of whom are also women.
Absolutely. I mean, just to quote a very horrific stat, just looking at the expanded definition alone, 72% of young women between the ages of 18 and 34 in South Africa, Black, are unemployed. And I think where at least some of the lessons we can learn from developed countries, especially if you look at the Nordic countries, is the orientation and the thinking around the paradigm around social security and grants, where it's seen as a collective for bettering the economy and society. Whereas in South Africa, we have created, and we should take responsibility as academics as well, where there's been theories of dependency theory concerning social security, where there's this narrative that if you are on a grant in South Africa, you are less than, you are being handicapped in some form of way. And while that is true in a sense, the handicap part, because you are excluded out of the economy, but we've turned it into a very negative connotation, and a very negative thing to be on a grant in South Africa. But I think there, the narrative and the case for something like a universal basic income is the fact that it's not only meant to support people that are handicapped or excluded, but it's going to be for everyone. And while we've done the numbers, only we anticipate a 70% uptake because people have a preference of choosing jobs over being on a grant. But the case is, while people are looking for jobs, they have money for transport, they have money for data to do the interviews, to actively participate. And if someone is a graduate and has the opportunity to do online interviews, they can do it. And it's a way of bettering our society and making sure that we don't live in a society of haves and have-nots, especially where the contrast is very stark in South Africa's case.
On the issue of dependency, there are those who believe that, if we spend whatever money would be allocated towards a basic income grant, then we're not only increasing and building a welfare state, but that money would be better spent creating or helping to create jobs.
I think the discourse we've always tried to avoid, it's not an either or. And even in our policy, in my research, we and many other researchers, we do say a UBI would be one of seven pillars that need to be in place. And what a UBI will do immediately is to inject money into an economy in South Africa. I had a meeting 2 weeks ago with the head of the IMF in Washington, D.C., where the region as a whole is expected to grow in the next year by 4%, but South Africa is only expected to grow by 1.4% in terms of GDP. So what a UBI will immediately do, it will put money into cash into the hands of people who will spend in the economy. But that said, if you look at just the food example, we need to make sure, which is the bulk of what the UBI recipients will be using it on, to make sure they have day-to-day food requirements, transport, etc. But if I just zone in on the food sector and some of the elements that need to accompany a UBI, South Africa will need to make sure, for example, if a large proportion of the UBI recipients are spending on canned beans, South Africa will need to make sure that they are producing those beans in the country and they're not exporting them, to make sure that we actually get the benefits of that injection into the economy. And these are the seven pillars we say that need to, because then that speaks to our industrial policy that need to accompany a UBI. It speaks to South Africa becoming actually a net exporter of food and not a net importer. And these are some of the UBI, for me at least, where the biggest value has been. It opens up these discourses and discussions into our economic policy, an economic CODESA that we actually never had as an economy. We may not all agree that a UBI is the solution, but it is a way that forces us to think and recognize that, A, we need to speak about our economy that has excluded a large proportion of young people in a continent that's predominantly young. We need to talk about the fact that we never had an economic CODESA, and that the benefits have largely not been felt in economic prosperity in South Africa by the majority of citizens. What can we do? And there are short-term policies like a UBI. And even at SPI, we propose a UBI for 3 years. After that 3 years, and while we even start with policies like UBI to just revitalize the economy and to kickstart it, it needs a change in our industrial policy. It needs a relook at our infrastructure development and stuff. And these are not things that are either or, they need to be happening at the same time. We need a holistic approach to it.
Russell, the conversation around what form this social protection should take is also an important one, right? What are the other models that we see in different parts of the world? So sometimes you'll hear people say, well, does it actually have to be cash, in people's pockets or people's bank accounts? So if you had the same thinking and said, well, if this is to largely deal with poverty and the fact that we have people that go to bed hungry, why not create a coupon system like they have in the US? So you would know better about what it is that some countries are doing in response to similar challenges.
I think, Kathy, there's an international consensus that it is infinitely better to give somebody cash, because I think it's based on the philosophical principle that as human beings, there's a level of autonomy that needs to be respected. In South Africa, for example, if you look at the child support grant, most of the caregivers are female-headed households or females who are in possession of this particular grant for their specific children. And study upon study in the South African context has actually demonstrated that women have made the best possible decisions. They haven't spent the money on alcohol or on cigarettes, as some people would allege. Look, there's some anecdotal evidence, but that's not scientific evidence. The evidence seems to suggest that you can successfully do a cash transfer program And those who pick up and those who participate in the program tend to spend the money wisely, judiciously. And the South African government, to its credit, has never imposed any conditions on the receipt of a social assistance intervention or social grant. So I think if we were to go that way into the future, I think it would be recommended. If you look at the rest of the continent, for example, the rest of the continent is copying South Africa. South Africa's way ahead in terms of where our particular social assistance systems are, Kathy. If you even look at Brazil, for example, Brazil has a very strong a cash transfer system. So cash transfers work. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Money in the hands of ordinary South Africans are not spent on malicious things, on things which are harmful to children or harmful to the community as such. You would have exceptions, but those exceptions do not define the norm. In terms of linking it to some form of condition or conditionality, I think that had been explored, at least in terms of ideas in the South African context. In other words, if somebody is receiving a child support grant, can we make sure that that particular child is actually participating in basic education? Or that child is actually accessing the necessary health services which are provided by the National Department of Health. But I do think that from a pure public finance point of view, when you think about a cash transfer, you think about transfers. Now, a transfer, by its very definition, increases the autonomy of a person receiving it, increases the purchasing power of a person receiving it. That's why civil society is always up in arms about the need to make sure that cash transfers actually keep pace with inflation, so that the discretionary buying power that sits with the person receiving the grant remains, et cetera, et cetera. So from our point of view, there's no need to invent a complicated system of coupons or whatever the case may be. Once you put hands into a responsible adult, a responsible caregiver, as had been proved over and over again in the South African context, they will make the best, and they do make the best possible decisions around children. I mean, if you look at what the Department of Social Development is doing, Kathy, that's a very good example. What they have done was to link those who received the child support grant, to link them to, for example, higher education. So an increasingly larger proportion of students entering tertiary education are actually coming off a grant system. So there's no fundamental objection to the fact that a cash transfer is actually a meaningful intervention in a society that is so desperate, becoming so fragile. And of course, we cannot possibly predict what the post-election situation is going to look like, but I would assume that there would still be a national consensus that we have to, at least with the present social assistance system, continue and perhaps even improve that system. But we can come back to the whole idea of the UBI, but definitely cash transfers in the hands of ordinary South Africans. Kathy?
Russell, you still have a number of people, and it could be primarily as a result of the myths and misunderstandings associated with social welfare and grants in particular. But you still have people that believe that giving cash incentivizes, in inverted commas, and I use that word begrudgingly because I know what the research says, but they believe that it incentivizes people to then not look for jobs. It incentivizes young girls to fall pregnant because they'll access the grant.
Kathy, if you look at the size of the grants, there's a built-in incentive within the grants that the grants will never be adequate to sustain a decent standard of living. The best example of that came when COVID-19 hit all of us. And the rate of poverty and the rate of hunger started climbing dramatically. Because prior to COVID-19, before the economy was locked down, those who were receiving grants were in a position to look for any kind of job, patch jobs, scratch jobs, whatever you call it. Everyone has a fundamental right to make a living. And grant recipients often have to supplement the grant income just to be able to live and just to be able to feed the family for the entire month. So we never really had a grant situation in South Africa where the monetary value of the grant is so large that it completely disincentivized people to go and look for work. And I think that's a fundamental point. It's almost like a built-in incentive because you want to strike a balance between giving somebody a cash transfer, but at the same time, as Norma so beautifully and eloquently put out, create the environment where things are a bit better for people to start accessing jobs and accessing work opportunities. But we don't at this point in time have a grant system where you can comfortably say, if I'm in receipt of this particular grant, I don't need to do anything else.
All
People
right.
are still hustling.
All
Yeah.
right.
Thank you,
We'll
Kathy.
continue the conversation in a moment. I see a number of you already lined up to contribute. We'll do that after the latest headlines.
The Talking Point with Kathy Motlatlana, weekdays, 9 a.m. till midday.
We continue the conversation on the talking point. We're looking at universal basic income. Of course, in South Africa, it's been coined under the basic income grant, which is a work that many activists and social groups have been part of to try and advocate for the need for universal basic income in this country. Nomakhlubi Jaguja is one of our guests alongside Russell Vilderman. I'm going to go to the phone lines and take some of your contributions to this conversation. Olani, you're calling from the Eastern Cape. Good morning.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
The issue of the basic income grant, it's got its advantages and disadvantages. I'm from the Eastern Cape, considered the most poorest province, and yet it's supposed to have the potential to be the most productive province. If we were to look at the resources that the province has, we've got the coast, we've got the forests, we've got the rivers. When you talk about water shortages, the Eastern Cape is not supposed to have that type of thing. We've got so much water going to the oceans, and it's not kept, put into there. But your guest, Nomashlubi, said something very important about the issues of infrastructure that maybe needs to be looked at. If the basic income grant has no conditions, no limits, we will find a situation where we have permanent dependability that leads to what I would term unconscious slavery, if we don't look into that. An ordinary example, a family where there is a couple, if it's Kolani and someone else, then there should be a limit of how many children must be supported by the state to avoid a situation where Kolani and his partner then now all of a sudden continue to breed children knowing that the state is going to support. That is one of the things that the state needs to look at in terms of how do you limitize the number. You're not limitizing people from having children. You're limitizing the number of children that the people want to be supported by the state. So it needs to have that space where there are conditions where they will be managed and controlled. And at the same time, the state allow infrastructure so that those who've got skills will do so. Because if they start to pump money to many people who are not working, the issues of demand and supply that is from a productive space, you will find that now the prices continue to rise. Why? Because the demand is increasing, and then there is money for for the producers. So prices continue to rise because people will all be having this minimum amount to spend.
So
that's
so,
my take on it.
So Kolani, just to understand, in terms of the limits that you have in mind, is it a limit that says if you have parents in a household that are on the basic income grant potentially, then the children that they have cannot receive the social grant, or that they can but up to a certain age, or what?
What should be happening is that the number of children that, even if it's any family that receives basic income grant or not, those that are eligible, there should be a limit. If you say we can, in this couple, have only three children that will be supported for the grant, because if then they continue to have many more children and yet they know that they don't have source of income to support, then you are increasing, you are creating a situation where dependency becomes this unconscious slavery, that you're going to have everybody else wanting to depend on the state.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Kolani, thanks for the point. I'll get our guests to respond in a moment. Colin in Cape Town, good morning.
Good morning, and good morning to your guest. Olani took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. these young, especially the young girls, limit the grant amount. Because I've got one, they get a grant. Two, three, four, five. I see them. I travel around in Cape Town. I see them. I see two, three, four, all on grants. And you know something? Your guest and the experts must get into cars and ride around in the cities. Not the cities, actually, in the suburbs, and see what goes on round about the second of each month to the fifth. You'll be surprised to see how many people, women under the influence and men under the influence of alcohol round about 2-3 o'clock the afternoon, lying under bridges, lying here, swearing at each other, using foul languages. They've spent that money that they just received from the post office. Now, that is the problem. And the government's also to blame. We import more than what we can even export and sell. We need infrastructure. We need factories. We need skilled workers, training people, plumbers, electricians, boilermakers, you name it. We need people in this country to do skill work, because that is where these people can find jobs and employ themselves as a plumber, as an electrician, whatsoever, as a welder, whatever it is. Employ, the government must look and make up their minds and employ these people, train them. I wouldn't want 350 rand. If I know the government's going to train me for a job, to hang with the 350 rand. I want a job. I don't want handouts.
Okay.
These experts must realize one thing. People don't want handouts. They want jobs. We need building factories. We import from China all our clothing, our leather, our steel. We sell our steel and iron ore and manganese to China. We buy it back again. What is going on with this government? The old government never did that. We melted, we used all our minerals, and we had steel, we had ISCO, we had foundries, we had everything in this country. The manufacturing industry has disappeared since this government came into power, and your guests know it. Thanks very much.
Okay, all right, Colin, out in Cape Town. Look, I guess a lot of things have changed about the country, but I'll stick to the point that you're making when it comes to the manufacturing sector and perhaps part of the regression that has been noted there. Dumile, you are in Ekala. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie, and your panel.
Yes.
I think what I want to say, some of the guys have touched up on it, but I think one thing we might be missing is that, you know, when you help someone physically, you also need to help them emotionally. What I want to get to is that as much as we do have policies, our policies don't seem to have a soul, and the soul that you can transfer to the actual implementers of the policy. I'll make an example. If, for instance, you come to SASSA and SASSA is giving their people money, is there an office that somehow advises people on how, not necessarily to tell people or direct them how to use money, but just to give them a conscious understanding of how to use the little money that they are getting from SASSA? Like this simple example of Nestor, who's a student who got 40 million rand by mistake and spent 80 million rand just splashing. Now, not to say that person at that age, with all the background they have, couldn't have done that. But I believe with counseling and debriefing of their situation, especially if you consider the fact that now you are going to give them money that they have not worked for, and they still have traumatic problems that relate to how they handle money. And if you don't deal with those things, then you have situations where people say, people are given money and they drink it. Yes, they drink it. We see it. And academics can deny it. But we people living here in rural areas, we know this thing. It's like, I mean, when we have sisters, they, not that they drink all of the money, but they drink some of it. Or they eat. So you can't deny all these things. And I think academics need to really speak to, not sympathize a lot. Yes, sympathy is fine, but we need to speak to the reality of the situation so that we can find the actual solution. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's very serious. Yeah,
okay. All right, Dumile. Thanks for that contribution. Russell, let me kick it off with you.
Thank you, Kathy. First of all, in response to Dumile's question, some time back we actually did a pilot or participated in a pilot with the University of Johannesburg, where they actually took recipients of the child support grant and then had a complementary system of people who were trained to teach caregivers financial decision making within the household, you know, what's the best way of looking after your children, et cetera, et cetera. And although it was at piloting stage and it's not yet been extended to the broader South African system, there would be an idea, there would be acceptance that you can actually establish alongside the receipt of the grant some form of formal education to those who are receiving the grants. This doesn't gainsay, I think, the reality that grants are normally used very productively. What you know, there's always a bit of what we call perception bias. So when you see things with your eyes, you may think that's the national pattern, not necessarily the case, because you haven't actually observed, you've observed one small part of a community, and then you come to a fundamental conclusion that people are not using grants constructively or productively. So I think we need to take that into account. Then quickly, just in terms of Colin's point, I think this is the point. I think this point will better be explained by Norma, where we're trying to avoid this sharp contradiction or the sharp opposition between giving cash in somebody's hand and building the productive investment or the productive infrastructure of the country. So I may ask, you may ask Norma maybe to speak to that a bit more. And then in terms of limiting the number of children, if they are your biological children, of course, in terms of the existing child support grant, it cannot be limited. But if you take, for example, responsibility for children who are not your biological children, then I think you're limited to six children who can actually qualify for the child support grant. So there are limitations, but not necessarily on biological children, because obviously it will raise constitutional and ethical issues if some of the children in the household are receiving grants and other children are not receiving, because it's a human rights issue, basically. So let me stop at that point, Kathy. Maybe ask Norma to intercede.
All right, Nomathubi.
Thank you so much. I think I enjoy these debates because they really allow us to debunk some myths. So when we make policy, we never make policy. We do a statistical model and we look at the 75% of the population, and the population being everyone in South Africa. You never want to make policy because based on the 25%, which we call them outliers. And those outliers can be the ones that are negatively spending the grants, or on the other end of the spectrum that are really have turned the policy, as we've done in our documentary, where we went into communities to find out how they actually spend the 350 grants. And some of them were starting businesses. It's now a big ice cream creamery initiative. So you don't look at the two extremes. You look at what the 75% of the population is doing. And there has been no research that the 75% of the population are misusing cash transfers and grants. So that's what we based the policy on. It's not to say there aren't people on both ends of the extremes misusing grants or using them for exceptional cases to start a business to compete with Paul's ice cream in Soweto. So you take the average 75%. What are they doing? Are they doing the are they spending it on food, which has been the case that the 75%, which is we tend to say majority, but it doesn't mean everyone, but it means the people that are in that 75% spectrum use it for good, or at least what the policy is intended for. And then just on the cash versus jobs discourse, we are again, we're not saying a UBI, and I think the caller made it so well that you could hear the urgency in the voice that they want jobs. And we're not saying a UBI is replacing jobs, but it's an enabler. If that Boilermaker wants to get to school to get the skills training, but has no income at the moment, is unemployed, doesn't even have money for transport, this is where a UBI, it's like such a small spec enabler that they actually, instead of having to borrow and convince a family member to give them transport money, but it gives them that urgency and that to that autonomy to have money that's coming in from the government every month, and they can use it for transport to get to the skills training facility to get to the job. But there's and even the amount itself, how we work it out. As Russell said previously, it's never going to incentivize anyone to stay on that grant as opposed to looking for a job. And
All
again,
right.
this is the 75% of people, but you, again, there are outliers in each policymaking scenario.
All right. Nomahlubi, Russell, let me thank you both for your time and your contributions to this conversation. A big thank you, as always, to our listeners, too. We will continue the conversation tomorrow between 9 and midday. Up next is the book reading. And, of course, you can stay tuned to SAFM. Certainly lots of engaging conversations throughout the day.